I'm on the road to recovery, step by step. Tears on my pillow that won't dry on their own beyond my ears. I've no sorrow, but today I don't walk alone.
Yeah,
'cause I'm on the road.
Big Book Study Group, Thursday Night Alcoholics and God, Speaker Step Series. Spencer, can we please have our joke?
Yes, Ben.
Hey, Spencer, alcoholic joke teller.
Spencer.
And I got another one from Take Me to Your Sponsor, Best Jokes and Cartoons from A.A. Grapevine. The rain was pouring down. Standing in front of a big puddle outside the pub was an old Irishman. Drenched, holding a stick with a piece of string dangling in the water. A passerby stopped and asked, "What are you doing?" "Fishing," the old man replied. Feeling sorry for the old man, the gent said, "Come in out of the rain and have a drink with me." In the warmth of the pub, as they sipped their whiskeys, the gentleman, being a bit of a smart aleck, could not resist asking, "So how many have you caught today?" "You're the eighth," said the old man.
Well done, Spencer. I'm a recovered alcoholic. My name is Zach. I'm going to introduce Don for our secretary.
Thank you, Zach. Good evening, everyone. I am Don. I am your recovered alcoholic secretary. Hey, guys. Now, in keeping with the seventh tradition, those baskets are... which states that every group should be fully self-supporting. Those baskets are going around now. We appreciate all your donations to keep this well-oiled machine rocking and rolling. Now, as I've asked my new friend Dean to read the recovery statement now, we read this notice to explain why many people in AA identified as recovered rather than recovering and what it exactly means to be a recovered alcoholic. Dean.
Hi, my name's Dean. I'm a recovered alcoholic. It says, recovered. We are not cured of alcoholism. Recovered but not cured. That presents a conflict to some alcoholics. If we are cured, we would be able to drink responsibly. No, we are not cured. The allergic reaction to alcohol will remain with us for our lifetime. But we have been restored to sanity. That was the problem. The main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than the body, page 23. We are now sane where alcohol is concerned. Consequently, we have recovered.
Thank you, Dean. 1940 style big book sponsorship and forward to the second edition of Alcoholics Anonymous. Of alcoholics who came to AA and early tried, 50% got sobered up at once and remained that way. 25% sobered up after summer lapses, and among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. Now, what we've seen, felt, come to believe, and experience is that God has not changed over time, and neither should his sacred approach back to his loving arms. Now, those statistics above suggest a 75% success rate, which is not too shabby, man, if you ask me. Now, anyone looking for a sponsor tonight, raise your hand. Anyone looking for a sponsor, need of a sponsor? We got one back there. Okay, we got one. Anyone else? All right. Those who are willing to sponsor, gentleman is available for sponsorship. At the end of the meeting, hang out by the literature rack in the back, and someone will find you, and it'll get you squared away. Cool beans. Can all the recovered alcoholics in the house raise your hand tonight? Nice, nice, nice. Now, if your hand was not raised, we suggest that you hang out with the ones who had their hand raised. Now, tonight is the last meeting of the month. Anyone celebrating a year or more tonight, raise your hand. Naming what you got. Congratulations. Anyone else? No? All right. Maybe next month. Oh, hold on. I can't see. Oh, yep.
My name's Matt. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic, 5 years.
Nice.
Alcoholic, 2 years on the summer.
Nice. All right. Congratulations, you guys. Keep it up. Keep it up. We'll see you next year for your next celebration. Now, time for some announcements. Intergroup is where you buy AA-related literature and medallions. Intergroup is also responsible for creating our Where and When and scheduling the AA hotline. Now, stop by and visit them. Next slide, please. BCIC is responsible for bringing meetings into places where people like us can't get into, such as jails and detoxes and the like. They meet monthly to organize at the 12-step house. Is anyone from BCIC in the house tonight? Raise your hand. 1, 2, 3, 4. Oh, our cup runneth over. If you're looking to get involved in BCIC, those who have raised their hands here will get you squared away. They sure could use your help and support. Now we have some other opportunities. A's Got Talent. This is this Saturday, I believe. Coral Springs Charter School. Tickets are still for sale. Lineup is packed, but there's still limited seating, so get your tickets, and I'm sure it'll be a good time. Next, now we have an appreciation banquet coming up on February 19th at the Intergroup Bookstore, so if you want to get involved in the planning that, show up there. That could use your help. And we have the man from Arizona here for two more nights, tonight and next week, before he rides off in the sunset. So it's been a real hoot having him the last 6 weeks. So we're sad to see him go, but as soon as Tom is out of here, we have Marion coming in for her six-week engagement. So we have a really packed lineup here. Very impressed, very impressed. Right here, I believe that's... Monday we have our big book study right in this very room right here where you're sitting at. We have tables instead of chairs. Come and join us for the big book study where the big book comes alive. We go through it page by page, line by line. It's very informative. If you're just learning, I'm a newcomer a year, and I'm learning the big book for the first time. So you learn something new every time you come here, so... Join us, and if you can't join us on Zoom. I think that's the end of that. Now, in the back of the literature rack, we have CDs, mugs, large print, big books, little red books, and big book dictionaries for sale. We meet every Thursday, starting promptly at 7:15. We ask that you be courteous and ready to begin at the Road to Recovery tune. Enjoy Tom tonight.
Thank you, Don. Thank you all for joining us tonight. In a minute, we're going to start our 2-minute meditation. So please take a moment to get situated. Please turn off all your devices that make noise and might will distract others. Take this time to get connected to God. Let the craziness of the day drift away. And ask God to help you stay focused on the step study tonight. Is everybody ready? Let's start the meditation. I'm going to lead the fog light prayer here. For those of you who don't know it, we have it shared on the screen here. God, let your love shine through me like a fog light, so those who are lost, sick, and dying can find your love through me. Amen. There is a solution from the big book, page 17. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. And I have asked my friend Amy to read Appendix 2, The Spiritual Experience. We read this because the main purpose of the 12 steps is to have one, so it is kind of important to know what one is. Please welcome Amy.
This is the spiritual experience. The terms spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which upon careful reading shows that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms. Yet it is true that our first printing gave many readers the impression that these personality changes or religious experiences must be in the nature of sudden and spectacular upheavals. Happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. In the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described. Though it was not our intention to create such an impression, many alcoholics have nevertheless concluded that in order to recover, they must acquire an immediate and overwhelming God consciousness, followed at once by a vast change in feeling and outlook. Among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Most of our experiences are what the psychologist William James calls the educational variety, because they develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often, friends of the newcomer are aware of the difference long before he is himself. He finally realizes that he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life, that such a change could hardly have been brought about by himself alone. What often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. With few exceptions, our members find that they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource, which they presently identify with their own conception of a power greater than themselves. Most of us think this awareness of a power greater than ourselves is the essence of spiritual experience. Our more religious members call it God consciousness. Most emphatically, we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. Herbert Spencer.
Thank you, Amy. Please refrain from disturbing others by talking or constantly getting up and sitting back down. This is a tech-free meeting, so set your phones to airplane/meeting mode or just turn them off. Time to introduce the speaker. This has been my first time going through a step series with Tom. I've really enjoyed his experience, strength, and hope. I think we're on 9 and 10 tonight, so let's welcome Tom.
Tonight, put my hat down here so I can see your faces in your eyes, you know. I like to make contact. My name's Tom, and I'm an alcoholic. Crank me up, man. Okay. So I like that Irish joke, so I got my own Irish joke, you know, because being the good Irishman I am, you reminded me of. And I love riddle jokes, right? So, Murphy fell down a whole flight of stairs with an open pint of whiskey and didn't spill a drop. Does anybody know how he did it? He kept his mouth shut. He's older than me, way older than me. Okay. Yeah, you know why God invented whiskey? It was to keep the Irish from ruling the world. All good Irishmen know that. So, yeah, I mean, one of the things, you know, and it reminds me, too, of, you know, I got sober. Thank you. Dean made me a hat. I've been sober ever since 1983. That's when I got sober, December the 9th, 1983. And I've always had a home group because I was taught by the guy I asked to be my sponsor. He said, listen, if you don't have a home group, you need to fire the sponsor. In other words, he was letting me know either go get you a home group or go find you another sponsor. Because this is about the fellowship. You know, you don't want to put all your eggs in one basket. That's not really a good idea, and it's not a good idea to place anybody on a pedestal in Alcoholics Anonymous, because we all have feet of clay. You know, just about the time if you were to put everything into me, you know, listen, I'm gonna fail you, man. I'm human. And I fail all the time. But my failures glorify my God, because he's perfect. And he's never failed me. He's always been there for me. I wasn't always there for him, but he's always been there for me. And it's easy for us, you know, to, we're going to talk about 9th to 10th step, and a little bit of 10th step. You know, it's easy for us to, it was very easy for me to become full of spiritual pride. You know, I had a great mentor. That man brought me to God. And that man was probably the last man in the world, you know, that you would have thought could bring anybody to God. Because that man had once been he's been long dead now, about 10 years. He died with 56 years at 93. And he was once a bookkeeper for the Chicago Outfit. His father was a bookkeeper of the Chicago Outfit for him. And the only way he got out is one night they're down in the Loop at a steakhouse. And they came out of there. Oh, and by the way, he had a full-time bodyguard. Not to protect him from anybody else, but to protect the mob from him and his drunkenness. Kind of like the same way that was done to me, you know. I thought the guy that I came up under, you know, was talking earlier tonight with one of the guys here about how I didn't get justice, you know. I got mercy. I'm sober by the mercy of God. I stay sober by the grace of God on a daily basis. And if I would have got justice, I'd still be in the penitentiary. Because not only was I an alcoholic and a dope addict, you know, dope fiend, but a criminal too. From the time I was a little kid. Because the first place I found that I belonged was in a gang. And from the fifth grade on, I always run with gang people. Gang people were my people. And so who better to bring me to God than a born-again ex-mafia guy? And that's who Dennis was. Every time he'd get up to the podium, he'd make sign of cross and he'd say, "My name's Dennis, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm sober by the mercy of God, and I stay sober by the grace of God. And I just want to thank you drug addicts for giving us alcoholics a good name." I went to him. I had maybe about, I don't know, 15 months or so. And I was on a pink cloud, big pink cloud, and worked all the steps. You know, I was feeling really good about myself, and I was, you know, really digging into all kinds of different things, you know, and because the big book tells you to see where, you know, religious people are right. You know, I mean, let's get over this. It's not AA approved. There's no such thing as AA approved, okay? What there is conference-approved literature that's approved by a conference and a committee in general service for them to print that and sell it for general service to print that. But you read your big book, it tells you to talk to your rabbi, talk to your minister, you know, talk to your priest. There's lots of books out there, you know. My sponsor has a bookcase that's as big as this back piece here and as high as that, filled with spiritual books. And I'm a seeker. You know, the ABCs talk about it. The ABCs, you know, that I'm an alcoholic and my life's unmanageable. And probably no human power could have relieved my alcoholism. And that God could and would if he were sought. Not found. Doesn't say found. Says sought. I'm a seeker. And I'll continue to keep seeking. You know, we'll talk more about it next week on the 11th step. The knowledge of God's will for me and the power to carry it out. My primary purpose is to stay sober and to help another alcoholic to achieve sobriety. I know who my boss is. My boss is God. My boss has been God, you know, since I got on my knees with that man who brought me to God and held his hand and said the third step prayer on my knees after the men's meeting in the old Legion Central House in Delray Beach with me staring out the door, nervous that some other man might walk inside and see me on my knees holding this old man's hand. But, you know, I was full of spiritual pride. I thought I really had this thing, and this lady came up to me. I asked if I told this story. I may have told a bit of it, but I don't think I told the whole thing. Because this group, you know, brought it back to me when I've been doing this for 10 years now for Mike, and I love it. And I love this group. I love what Mike does, and I love what his group does. And let's give him a big hand because they... Hey, Mike and his guys work really hard to put this on, you know, and to help carry the message to people, you know, and that's what this is about, carrying the message. You know, and when I first came back and I saw that, I says, I hadn't seen that in a long time, not since Dennis O. I went to him because a lady came to me in the old American Legion Central House in Delray Beach, and she had a book. And she told me, she said, God told me to give you this book because you're going to help so many people. And I thought, wow, you know, and I got, my head started really swelling up, you know. And I thought, that's right, you know, I'm going to help so many people, you know. And so Dennis and me, we were up Denny's after the meeting, and we're sitting there, and I said, Dennis, you'll never believe this. This old lady came up to me in the central house and gave me a book and told me that God told her to give me that book because I'm going to help so many people. And Dennis looked at me and said, yep. He said, and the name of the book was A Course in Miracles, right? And I said, yeah, how'd you know? And he said, she told me the same thing. Cut you off right at the knees there, you see. Because I'm going to tell you, I'm a guy that's always needed right sizing. All right? You know, I remember when I had 2 years sober, I had a good friend, old guy's dead, long dead now, named John Lilly, and he helped all kinds of people. He helped all kinds of people. And you never even knew about it until after he died. Because Dennis used to have a way of saying things. He'd say, you know what, when we do something bad, we don't want anybody to know about it. But when we do something good, we want to tell the whole world about it. Why don't you try doing something good and don't tell anybody about it? Why don't you try doing that? See how you can do at it, you know. Keep your mouth shut, like Murphy. Maybe you won't lose your pint of whiskey. And I said, how'd you know that? Well, she told me the same thing. He said, Tommy, I understand you. He said, I was just like you back up in Chicago years ago. He said, and my buddy, I had a buddy like you, and we were searching for enlightenment. We were searching all over the place for enlightenment. We wanted to be enlightened. And my buddy told me, he said, you know what, Dennis? My grandmother, great-grandmother, is full-blooded Chippewa up in Wisconsin on the reservation, and she's the sage of the tribe, 105 years old. And they have these big powwows, you know, and bonfire at night, and we need to go up there and hear what she's got to say. So we go up there, and we sit down, you know, late at night, and they bring the old lady out. They got the big bonfire going, and he said, and the old lady looks right at me. And she said, son, I can tell that you're interested in something. What is it that you're interested in? And he said, well, ma'am, he says, we're interested in enlightenment. We want to be enlightened. And she said, ah, yes, enlightenment. Before enlightenment, chop wood and carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood and carry water. You see, I understood right then what he meant. That cut me down to size two. He said, you know what, Tom, you're never going to be some guru sitting on the side of some mountain somewhere where life is not going to touch you. Life's going to touch you. You're never going to be perfect. You're never going to be without fault. You're never going to be without failure. And all you can do is just try your best. This is about willingness. What are you willing to do? You don't have to run around all over the place searching for God. Because I'm going to tell you something, Tom. God's going to speak to you right from the mouths of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. All you have to do is learn how to listen. Listen to learn and learn to listen. In the ninth step, it starts out on step nine in the 12 and 12. After we have made the list of people we have harmed, have reflected carefully upon each instance, and have tried to possess ourselves of the right attitude in which to proceed, we will see that the making of direct amends divides those we should approach into several classes. There will be those who ought to be dealt with just as soon as we can become reasonably confident that we can maintain our sobriety. There will be those to whom we can make only partial restitution, lest complete disclosures do them or others more harm than good. And there will be other cases where action ought to be deferred, and still others in which, by the very nature of the situation, we shall never be able to make direct personal contact at all. This come up before, especially it's come up at times when men that I've worked with had problems like mine with crime. Now, if there's warrants and you're wanted, you need to clean that up. But how are you going to help yourself or your loved ones or anybody else to go turn yourself in for something that nobody even knows that you did? But I have been told by men that other fools in this program have told them that they need to do that. One young man committed suicide. You know, I learned a long time ago, I'm a sober alcoholic, okay? And that's who I am. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a marriage counselor. I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a counselor. I'm just another bozo on the bus that's trying to stay sober. And what I need to do is what I was taught to do by a little man named Ron Martin. I use these, me and my sponsor use people's names who are dead. Okay? Because that's how we remember them. Ron Martin, I heard him say a long time ago in a meeting in the Central House, he said, you know what? I don't come to Alcoholics Anonymous to give advice. And I don't come to Alcoholics Anonymous to take advice. I come to Alcoholics Anonymous to share my experience, strength, and hope. And that's what I come to listen to, because that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope, not their opinions and ideas. And so I took that to heart, and I've been living that way for over 40 years in this program. Now, you ask me for my opinion, I'll give you my opinion. And I got plenty of opinions. I'm just full of opinions. I'm very opinionated about everything. But when I'm carrying the message, I'm talking about my own experience, strength, and hope. That's what I'm up here doing with these steps. I'm telling you my own experience, strength, and hope with the step. Not lecturing to you about the right way you ought to do things. Because there ain't no right way. You know, I grew up in this program being taught that you have to find what works for you. You got to be comfortable with this program. That's why we call them suggestions. You know, we suggest if you jump out of an airplane with a parachute on that you pull the ripcord. So if you pull the ripcord with the right hand or if you pull the ripcord with the left hand, it really doesn't make much difference which hand you pull the ripcord with, does it? All that matters is that you pull the ripcord. So listen, you know, when it comes to making amends, I said to my sponsor, I said, you know, man, I was a street guy. I'm a guy off the street. I'm the type of alcoholic from those times that could lay in the gutter and look down on you. I'm a low bottom snob drunk, okay? And you know, I get kind of emotional when I talk about it. But I did a lot of things that I never got caught for. Because I was a dirty guy. And I'd done a lot of dirt. I'd done a lot of dirt to people. I can remember, you know, I'd come awake in the morning from being passed out. I didn't go to sleep, I passed out. And the first thing I'd do is look for my glasses. And if I could find my glasses, I'd look out the window. I lived on the second floor, and I'd look out the window to see if the car was there. Because I used to leave my car in blackouts all over town. And I'd have to get people to take me all around town to look for my car. One time I lost my car for 2 weeks. And I was drinking up in a bar, and some fella said, "You want to go downtown to drink?" Because downtown was a 4 o'clock joint. So I said, "Yeah." We went out in the alley, and there's my car. 2 weeks been sitting in the alley out there. So I had a 68 Le Mans, and I looked out the window, and all I could see was the glass looked like, you know, something was smeared all over it. And I went down, and I opened the car door, the coupe, and I looked, and the back seat was covered in blood. I don't know what I did. To this day, I don't know what I did. I did all kinds of things. Things that nobody's looking for me for. That I didn't have to make a direct amends over. And wondered to my sponsor, how am I supposed to handle this? Because, you see, we think in this mindset of direct demands that I have to make some direct, I have to go say I'm sorry to somebody, which is what we mistakenly think these amends are about. When really what they're about is building a new character. You see, we used to talk about that, and I never wanted to talk about that. In my men's meeting, we talk about building a new character all the time. And I came here, you know, I came here 51 years ago. It took me 10 years around AA. I used to say I was in and out of AA for 10 years and never got a year. I was just around AA for 10 years and never got a year. Until I finally surrendered and got my first year. It took 11 years to get that first year. And they'd talk and they would say to me, "You know what, Tom, if you don't change the guy that brought you in here, that's the same guy that's been taking you back out all these years." I remember when Dennis looked me in the eye and he said, "You know what, Tom, I was a liar, a cheat, and a thief, and I never met another alcoholic who wasn't." And the first thought went through my mind was, is he talking about me? I mean, he can't be talking about me. I'm a stand-up guy. I'm a nice guy, you know. Can't be talking about me, not me. Because I lived in a delusion that I was some nice guy, some stand-up guy. When I'd steal your drugs and help you look for them. When I'd get you drunk and try to take your wife to bed, okay? And then I thought I was the best friend you could have. I was a scumbag. And like so many scumbags I know that used and drank, we all done all kinds of stuff that we can't pay for. You think you can't pay for them, right? That's what I thought. I thought, well, how am I supposed to pay for this? I can't pay for this. And my sponsor, who was a tough sponsor, a tough man, he tackled me in the street one time. I mean, that's the kind of sponsor I had. I had this girlfriend who lived in the trailer park, and I had no license. I rode over on the bike to see her, and her bushes were all cut down nice and right at the windowsill, and nice and flat. They had been all overgrown. And I said, "Well, who did that?" And she said, "Well, you know, the boy that lives down the street that cuts my grass, his father did it." I said, "Yeah, what'd he charge you?" "Well, he didn't charge me anything." I said, "No, wait a minute now. Men don't do stuff for women for nothing, okay? There got to be something here." "No, he's a nice guy. He's just a nice guy, yeah." So my sponsor could pick me up, and he's going to take me to meet, and then he's going to bring me back because I'm going to stay tonight. And we get back. And she unlocks the door. She's on the phone. The door was locked. She's on the phone in hysterics to the sheriff's deputy because she came out of the shower and he was peeping in there. And then he came to the door and he was trying to force the door open, yelling and screaming what he was going to do to her. And I was on my, when he got that out of his mouth, I was on my way out the door down the street. I'm going into his trailer, kick his door in. When my sponsor tackles me in the middle of the street, gets on top of me, and he says, "You're not an outlaw no more. You're a citizen now. And you got to let the police handle things." the way other citizens do things. You don't take the law into your own hands anymore. You got to change, become a different person than who you always were. I said, but then how am I supposed to make amends to all these nameless, faceless people and things that I'd done in my life? I can't make amends for it. He said, who said you can't make amends? That's just what you think. Well, tell me then, how am I supposed to do it? And he said, you're going to make spiritual amends. And God's going to show you how it's done. God is going to put it in you. And you'll know what you have to do. And I've been doing that for over 40 years now. God tells me when I need to do something. And I do it. You know, the family is the biggest thing that I needed direct amends to give to. Because I was always, you know, I was terrible to my family. My mother, who was a beautiful, kind woman, well-bred, came from a fine family. She used to come down looking for me, and I drank in the worst joints in town. And she'd come in there looking for me to drag me out of there, drag me home. So I had a sister. I've got a sister she has 9 months more than me in this program, lives up in Port St. Lucie. I took her to her first meeting, and I went and got drunk. That's why she's got 9 more months than me. And our mother tried to love us to death, okay? For those of you with alcoholics in your life, I remember her going to Al-Anon, and they told her, you need to cut those children loose. And she said, F you. Those are my children. I'm not cutting them loose. Of course not. So she almost loved us to death by always caring for us. Come down in them joints looking for me and drag me home, and I'd cry and carry on about how sorry I was, and I was going to be a good boy, and I wasn't going to act like that anymore. And as soon as I'd get well and things would get better, I'm gone. I'm gone one time, a couple years, and I'm out on the road, you know, hitching, bumming around. I was up on 10 north of New Orleans, and I run into this other bum on the road there, and he had some weed, and I had some wine, and I says, what you doing? He said, I'm just out on the road. I says, well, we can go down to Key West. You know, we can party down there in Key West, and we can stop in Pompano. My mother lives there. She'll put us up. We went to the door. I had a beard like this, hair down here, and I knocked on the door, and I'll never forget, my mother opened the door, and she looked right in my face, and she said, can I help you? And I said, Ma, it's me. My God, what have you done to yourself? And who's this bum? I said, this is my buddy. One night, that's it. One night, and you're out of here. So she was always trying to help me. She would even go into these places, and I'd see her coming down the street out the window, and I'd run and hide in the bathroom. And she'd come in there, and she'd say, now listen, I know he's in here, and I know you all got drugs in your pockets. And if you don't get him out here, I'm going to call the cops and have the cops in here. They come in the bathroom and say, get the hell out of here. Go with your mother. We don't want no trouble, all right? So, you know, you got to talk to your family. Now, my father was an alcoholic. My father used to see his father sleeping on skid row in doorways and stuff. My old Irish grandma, she wouldn't divorce him because they didn't believe in divorce. So he was a periodic. He was a barber, and he'd lock up the barber shop, and he'd go just live on skid row and stay drunk for a while. He'd go sleep in his poor mother's bed, and she slapped my chair. She lived dirt poor in a damn flat, cold water flat. Because my great-grandfather was a bum, too, who'd gone off to Portland and never came back. And them old people didn't have Social Security in them days. People in them days lived in poverty, old people. And so he hated his old man. He went to his grave hating him. He used to come sit down when he got old with me, and try to think I was going to tell him something that would change it, you know. And I would say, well, don't you understand, David, if you'd forgive him, if you would forgive him, it would free you. And he would say, he don't deserve to be forgiven. You know, and he was not a man that I never saw him hug my mother. I never heard him tell her he loved her. He never told us children that he loved us. But I'm going to tell you this. He was always there. He was always there for you. When you needed him, you could count on him. He was somebody who could be counted on. Because his old man couldn't be counted on. His grandfather couldn't be counted on. They were bums. I hadn't seen him in a couple of years. I'm up in Illinois. And he'd made it big. He had the house on the ocean down there in Ocean Ridge. He'd driving a new Jaguar, got in the real estate business, making $1 million. A few years, he made $1 million a year. He walks in the courtroom. I'm sitting in the courtroom waiting to get arraigned on 26 charges. And they walk in with the highest paid criminal attorney in town, who I know, everybody knows. They walk up and the judge stops the whole arraignment. He's arraigning everybody. In the courtroom, they talk to the judge. They go and sit down. The judge goes, and I walk up. He puts his hand over the microphone. And he says, well, Mr. Matthews, he says, you got two choices. You can go to the Illinois penitentiary, or you can go to Florida with your father. I said, well, Your Honor, I said, I guess we're going to Florida. He said, that'd be a good idea. It'd be a good idea you don't ever come back to Illinois again either, because if you come in front of me, I'll make sure you spend plenty of years in that penitentiary. So I owed him a lot. And I told my sponsor, I said, he's not an emotionally available person. You can't really talk to him, you know. But I need to talk to him. And so my sponsor said, but what you do is you write a letter. You write that letter and you take it to him. So I poured my heart out in this letter, about 4 pages, how sorry I was for the life I led and everything else. And I went over to see him. He had a little parlor. He says, well, come in here. And he would save everything. Let me tell you, he grew up dirt poor in the Recession. He didn't buy Ziplocs. He washed out bread bags. He didn't buy Tupperware. He washed out margarine bowls, okay? If he had wrapping paper, he slowly opened it so he could save the wrapping paper, peel the tape off of it and stuff. That's the way them old-timers were. He'd take the envelope, and he slowly opens the envelope real nice so it don't tear and everything. And I'm watching him. He takes that letter out of there, and he goes through it. He reads it all, and he folds it back up real nice and neat, and he puts it back in the envelope. And he stands up, and he hands me that envelope, and he said, that's nice, Tom, and he walks out the room. And I was heartbroken. When I went to my sponsor, and my sponsor told me, he said, well, you just got a good lesson. See, the lesson you got is you went there thinking to be forgiven. That's a big mistake. Because that's not what this is about. This isn't about you being forgiven. This is about you changing. And so for many years in sobriety, he and I got closer and closer and he got where, you know, he used to favor my younger brother, and he was in business with him, but he got good with me, even though he argued with me about a lot of things. He always did. But he got good with me, and in the end, he got to be up in his upper 80s, you know, and my mother would call me and say, he's driving me crazy. And I'd say, what do you mean he's driving you crazy? Well, he goes to the bank every day. Well, so what if he goes to the bank? Well, he wants to look at his money. And they won't show him his money, you know. He grew up dirt poor in the Depression, okay? Used to hide their money behind bricks in the basement because the banks all went dead, okay? That's before they had FDIC. And he gets mad and he moves his money into other banks. And I'm afraid he's going to forget which bank he puts the money in. And he's going around with all kinds of money in his pocket. He's 88, 89 years old. He's going around with $5,000, $6,000 in his pocket. I found $7,000 underneath the spare tire in his trunk. He's hiding money all over the place, you know. And she called me one day and she said, "You got to do something. He's sitting in here. He's got $20,000 sitting on the table staring at it in cash. And he had mail all over the place, you know. He'd go crazy over all the mail. And he'd call me on the phone and he'd say, "I want you to come over here and take my sweepstake stuff to the mail, because I know the mailman's stealing my sweepstakes. So you take it to the post office, because I'm supposed to be getting that sweepstakes money, okay?" And I'd say, "Okay, Dad, don't worry. I'll go and get it. I'll take care of it." So before I went over there, I downloaded a power of attorney, and I walked in. And I said, "Dad, what you doing?" "I don't know, Tom." He got a little clarity. I said, "Dad, why don't you let me take your money, take your mail, sign this power of attorney. I'll start taking care of everything. I'll take care of it all. You don't have to worry about nothing no more." "Okay, Tom." Pushed the money over to me. He said, "Give me a receipt." Then every once in a while, I'd say, "How's our money doing?" I said, "Money's doing good, Dad. It's doing good." He'd never been sick. He hated doctors. He was 91 years old. And he had to go to the hospital. He had Mercer, and the Mercer was moving to his heart. Took him to the hospital. He said, "I'm not staying here." I said, "You're staying here." "No, I'm not." I said, "Well, you're sick. You have to stay here. You're taking me home." I said, "I'm not taking you home." He said, "I'll hitchhike home." I said, "You're 91 years old." I said, you can't be hitchhiking home." "Well, I'm going to." I said, "Well, you're going to stay here." I get to the house, and they call me. They said, "We just caught your dad buck naked going through the lobby." So I come back, and they had him up. I come off the elevator, and they had him in the nurse's station in his pajamas and in a wheelchair. "Hey, how you doing?" They had him all drugged up. They put him on Halidol, if you know what that is, a chemical restraint. They kept him drugged up. He had a pick that ran all the way to his heart. He yanked it out 9 times. He fought with all the nurses. They had his hands all balled up like fighting gloves on him. They called me and they said, "There's nothing more we can do for him. And the hospice people want you to meet with him." And I said, "Okay." I come down in the morning. And they knew he was going to hospice, so they took him off the Halidol. And I made the arrangements. And I said, "I'm going in to talk to him." And I went into his room at the side of his bed. It was kind of dark in there, and he had his hands all balled up. He went like this. And I leaned over him, and he looked me in the eye, and he said, "I'm through." Now, I said, "I know you're through. Now, I'm going to have you put someplace nobody's going to bother you no more." And he looked me in the eye, and he said, "I knew I could count on you. And I knew my amends were made 28 years later." That's what it's about. Becoming a new and different person. That's how we amend our life. I love Bob Anderson's practical way that he has at looking at things, you know. He's in a retreat, and he's talking in the retreat, you know, doing the steps, and one of the retreat persons in there says, "Should we put ourselves on the amends list? You know, this is a good question," Bob says. "There's no way that I could put myself on the list and forgive myself and make things all right. It isn't enough for me to forgive myself or to think that I can somehow help myself by doing that. I have to do something different. I have to be the man I should be in the day I'm in, according to the 12 steps. I have to change. So I have to put other people down on the list and then make amends to them all." Not to myself. The only way I can stop hurting is to become the new character. That's the only way. I can't make amends to myself. Self doesn't have the power to forgive self. It just doesn't work that way. I tell people, your God has forgiven you already. You don't need to worry about forgiving yourself. Unless you're just full of the reverse pride of thinking that you're so terrible and so bad. Like in my four-step, when I thought, you know, I'm leaving that out of there. That's so terrible, I can't tell another human being about that. I can't tell anybody about that. And I went to a meeting, and the meeting was on the fifth step. The man was sharing, and he talked about how he'd left that out of there. He was going to take it to the grave. And how for the next 5 years, he was miserable. Couldn't move on the steps. Went to psychologists and stuff. Working with therapists. He got a new sponsor, and the new sponsor and him pinpointed it. It was what he left out of the fifth step. And they went back and redid it. And he moved on with his life. And everything changed. And I knew that God had sent that man there that night to talk to me. Now I'd already messed around long enough, 10 years of messing around. And I went back and I put all that stuff in there. And I shared that with my sponsor. I'll never forget what he told me. He said, Tom, how long has human beings been around? I said, well, I heard the oldest skeleton they found is about 3 million years old. He said, that's a long time human beings have been around, right? I says, yeah. He said, so what makes you think you could think of or do anything that ain't been thought of or done already? Who you think you are? You know, that's just the way it is, isn't it? You know, we want to think that we're just so terrible. Why do we think that? You know, this tenth step is a wonderful thing. You know, this is the way I stay where I am in the day that I'm in. And you know, thank God for the sponsor I had. Because the sponsor I had was, you know, the kind of a person that understood that you have to be able to have steps that you can apply in your life. You can't have steps that are so outrageous that you're just not going to do them. And I'm going to tell you, I've been around a long time. And I'll bet you, and listen, I'm sober 41 years, and I still go to 6 meetings a week, every week. And I work with lots of alcoholics, and I have a lot of old-time sponsees that are easy to take care of, but I always have about 5 guys I'm working the steps with. Okay? Because this is what keeps me sober. It's what keeps me on the beam. It's what keeps me right in what I do. And I'll bet you, out of my own knowledge, this is an opinion, because it can't be proven, but I'll bet you only about half the people in Alcoholics Anonymous even do a 10th step. Even look at themselves on a daily basis. The 10th step is a great thing because the 10th step is how we put the steps into application. So I'll give you an example. I got a terrible habit of always running late. Where in the hell's that time go? I thought I had enough time. What happened to it? Now I'm in a big hurry. And listen, when I was working, you know, I had an important job. I was very important. And I had meetings I had to attend, and I had to be there on time. And I'm in a big hurry because I'm late, and I'm trying to get to 95, and there's this guy in front of me, and he's just poking along. And I'm running up on his rear end, and I'm honking the horn, you know. And I'm, I don't know, years sober. Probably 20 years sober. I'm getting up there on his back, you know, like I'm going to ram him and honking the horn. Hey, why don't you get out of the way, you know? And finally I get a chance. And I mean, I'm really behaving badly, very badly. And I get a chance to run around him. And when I run around him, I look mean, you know, like that. And, man, it's this little old man and this little old lady. And they're scared to death. And I think, man, you're really an asshole, you know. How could you do that? Made me sick to my stomach. And you know what a spot check inventory is? Well, I'll tell you what it is. That's where you admit it right then to God. God's who you admit it to. I say to my God, this is a piece of my behavior that doesn't serve me or anybody else. God, please remove this from me. Remove it from me. You know what happens for years now since then? That was over 20 years ago probably. Ever since then, what happens when I'm in that traffic and I start to feel that emotion start to come up on me, the picture of that old man and that old lady come in my mind. And I calm the hell right down. I said, we're just going to let God run the show here. I'm just in the action business. I'm not in the outcome business, okay? And when we look at ourselves at night, we can ask ourselves what I was taught, three real simple questions. Just ask yourself these three simple questions. What did I do today that I felt bad about? Because I can't keep doing the same thing day in and day out and feeling bad about it. That'll have ramifications if I do. And did I rise above my feelings today? Because I'm human. It's okay for you to have feelings. It's okay that I have those feelings when I get up on them in traffic and stuff. But did I rise above that? Did I practice self-restraint? Did I bite my tongue? One of the greatest character builders there is. And building my character is to learn how to keep my mouth shut. To live and to let live. Is it really so important to be right? I mean, the maniac that came in here 41 years ago was so aggressive, all he cared about was being right. I had to be right, and you had to be wrong. And I'd fight with everybody. But would you rather be right or would you rather be happy, like to say? I had to learn I'd rather be happy. It's okay. You can be right. I won't argue with you. Go ahead, be right. Bob was talking about that somewhere. He was saying, I let them all think. Even when I'm right, I say I'm wrong. Don't matter to me anymore. It's not important. I don't care what you think about me. I don't care what you got to say about me. What you got to say about me ain't none of my business. It's none of my business what you got to say about me, okay? You can talk about me all you want. I love for you to talk about me because I'm an egomaniac. So even if you ain't talking good about me, you're still talking about me, right? I love for you to take my inventory. You know what? It might help you with your own. Let's look at Father John Doe. I have to tell you these books because, you know, this is one book here, Mind Power Disease by Bob Anderson, who completely reinvigorated my sobriety, long dead now. Died in 97 with 47 years. He got sober when I was born in 1952. And Father John Doe, who was one of the greatest writers back in the 40s, did the Golden Books and Sobriety and Beyond, Serenity Without End. He's talking about the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, about character. He says, in general, we find three classes of AAs, three overall attitudes, which in turn give us the good, the bad, and the indifferent AA. In the first of these classes, we have the members who have acquired a completely spiritual attitude toward the program. They have become convinced of the primacy of the spiritual, and all of their AA activity and their entire lives are regulated and directed by spiritual values. To them, material prosperity, etc., are only secondary and ever dependent upon the will of God, which to them has become their unfailing roadmap. They never slip. They are the ones who display in their every action, in their countenances, in their every word, peace, contentment, and serenity. They are the ones who are always doing so much, yet unseen. They are the ones who have fully experienced the expulsion of the compulsion to drink. To them, liquor is no longer a problem, no longer a temptation, no longer even a matter of much thought. They are truly spiritual men and spiritual women. And far from being morose, apart, and alone, they are the very backbone of every AA group. They are the ones who have acquired a completely spiritual attitude. The second class of AAs are the indifferent ones. They are the ones who have a half and a half point of view, a partly spiritual, partly material attitude. They are the ones who have a spiritual attitude in some phases of AA in their lives, but who still in many things put material values above their ultimate spiritual values. They are the victims again and again of that time-worn rationalization, you got to be practical. They have never really taken the time to think through the ultimate road and have often turned off because the pavement looks very smooth. They're often victims of the squirrel cage, drink cravings, resentments, because they are more or less often determinedly seeking material advancements ending in conflicts. Many slip, many stay sober, but all of these will never know the meaning of serenity. Fortunately, many ultimately acquire the spiritual attitude and come to realize the primacy of the spiritual the hard way. They are the bulk of AAs. In the third class, we find the AA members, if they can be called such, who have a completely material attitude. They are the no-God individuals, the no-spiritual angle boys and girls, the first step Johns. They have come to the point of being convinced that they are alcoholic but not unmanageable. They know liquor has them whipped and how they hate it. The being whipped, not the liquor. Their every striving and longing and determination is for material advancement, material pleasure, material well-being. And with all they expect to stay sober, they don't. Even their weeks or months or even in odd cases their years of sobriety are a constant struggle against a drink. They are the dry drunks, dry and very unhappy. But ultimately, the first drink comes along and they slip. A few come back, not only sobered, but finally convinced of the primacy of the spiritual. Many of them slip and never come back. We would like to say that they, in reality, had never came in. Boy, they really hadn't. Thanks for letting me share tonight.
Let's all thank Tom again. We have tonight's session and all our past speakers podcasted for free at alcoholicsandgod.org. Again, I'd like to invite everyone to our Monday night big book study in this room at 7:15 p.m. Those who wish to thank tonight's speaker, please line up down the center aisle. And let's close with the Lord's Prayer, seated. Our Father.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Yes.
Thirsty bodies aching. I am desperately in need of restoration.
Shining through, but when wandering. So stop your sighing, baby, and be happy again. Yes, and keep on smiling. Keep on smiling, baby. And I hope.
Out in the dark, I'm gonna let it shine out in. Michael Chase. Here's that song you've been asking me for a million years. I finally pulled it out the corners of my mind, and here you go. Song is. God bless. I love you, Mike Chase. Bye.
I think you know this one, don't you? I've worked so hard for someone I don't know. so, so low. Got one man that just won't say.